Thank you for listening to this talk, produced by the Art Gallery of South Australia.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for the first of two sessions of Artist Talks. It's really great for you to be here, and it's really great to be meeting on beautiful Kaurna country, where we recognise that it was and always will be Aboriginal land. To help facilitate the public programs this weekend, I called on my family and friends, and I'm delighted to have Peter Rake here to talk with Tina, Jacobus, Lawrence and Paul. Peter is the director of UQ Art Museum, previously curator and director of creative residencies at Banff, a wonderful human who works on long-term projects with a whole range of different creatives and thinkers, most recently at UQ, the incredible Blue Assembly, which looks at our relationship to oceans. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Jose. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge that we are on Kaurna land, and I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners and their care of this country that we are gathered on today. I acknowledge any First Nations people that are in the audience with us, and I tread lightly here as a visitor until I leave on Sunday morning. My name is Peter Rake. Thanks for the intro. I'm the Director Senior Curator at University of Queensland Art Museum in Meganjin, Brisbane, and that is on unceded Turrbal and Yuggera land. I want to thank Jose just first up for actually a really exceptional exhibition. I think biennials are and can be difficult, but you have really pulled together so many beautiful works and artists, and just I suppose touching upon something that you said before about long-term relationships, that's very present in all of the works and I suppose artists that are present in this show. Tina reminded me on the dance floor on Thursday night that we are all strangers, only for a second. So welcome everyone here. We are no longer strangers. I have the pleasure today of speaking with Lawrence, Paul, Jacobus, as well as Tina. And we're going to start off today with the artists all introducing themselves and locating their practices for us. So I'm going to start with Lawrence over on my right here.
Hi, everyone. My name's Lawrence English. I'm from Meanjin, Brisbane, on Turrbal and Yuggera country. It's a very great pleasure to be here on Kaurna country. Someone once described me as a professional listener, which I thought made me sound like a kind of second-rate therapist. but I kind of like that. So I most of my practice is around listening. The work that I have as part of the biennial is out the front of the building at the moment, the proximity bell. So we'll be ringing it again this afternoon. In fact, if anyone wants to come and ring with us, 4:45 out the front, I'd love to have you there.
Thanks, Lawrence. Paul?
My name's Paul Knight. I'm from northern New South Wales originally, but living in Germany now, in Berlin. I guess I would say my practice extends in whatever form out of this inquiry or concern around intimacy and how intimacy facilitates for people. If you've got a bit of time, I've got a bit of a story.
Please, again.
So I guess just to contextualise my work and where it's ended up now, originally I used to photograph mainly all empty interiors and interiors that were, sites of intimate engagement between people, but no people present. And through conversations with my lovely brother, these deep conversations, he would press me to go to the thing. Why don't you just go to the thing? So that led in a massive shift to actually photographing people and doing work around people, I would say. Yeah.
I think we're going to talk a little bit about love today as well, so we'll come back to that one. Jacobus?
Hello. My name's Jacobus Capone, and I'm from Western Australia, but I travel around quite a bit each year pursuing projects in the mountains or in the Arctic, because I've found a real connection to quite severe locations. And my practice I'm not sure how to describe it. It constantly feels like a state of journeying and a lot of self-initiated pilgrimages to certain sites to be influenced and to kind of seek out a poetic harmonisation in terms of engaging with certain sites and then bringing that back to everyday life and extending that to engagements with other human beings or just treading as softly and not leaving a trace and an effect on the earth and across a whole pile of different mediums, depending on the conceptual premise of the project that I'm pursuing.
Thank you. Tina?
Hi, everyone. My name's Tina Stefanu, and I live and work on Wurundjeri country about an hour outside of Naam. And I consider my practice a living practice that is undisciplined, and that works with different communities, animals, socioeconomic positions, that is centred on vocality and the voice.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. So today we are going to, I suppose, have a think about all of these practices together, as well as dive into each work that the artists have presented as part of Inner Sanctum. So there are, I suppose, many threads that connect, but I wanted to mention a few that I think we can kind of hold on to today as an audience to think through. So it's about the hum that connects us all. It's about love and collapse. And it's about all the relations between human and non-human beings that inhabit this earth. These works suggest how we might commune with one another, both intimately and collectively. All of the works suggest some sort of acoustic connection with one another, and that's a word that Jose uses a few times throughout the artist's text that he's written about their work. And that is kind of used as a specific locator or kind of a key scaffolding in their practices, whether it's latent or not. The works, I suppose, are quite literally in concert with one another. We hear echo, breath, silence, whispers and laughs, and they are heard in unison or in discord. These sounds might be a call to arms. They might mark time. They might ask for a pause, or they might be a warning. And I want to start with sound as a warning, specifically with Jacobus's work, which is, I suppose, quite literally called forewarning. And I'm hoping, Jacobus, that you could really, I suppose, geolocate us in your work, and then we can kind of have a bit of a discussion about the importance of that particular place.
Sure. The location the work was filmed in and performed in was Svalbard, which is an archipelago up high in the Arctic, quite close to the North Pole. I went there in 2013 specifically for a different project that dealt with journeying down meltwater channels to the heart of a specific glacier. And I went there during winter, which meant it was 24 hours of darkness. And whilst pursuing that project, near the end of my time there, I exited out from the glacier and came across this really nice pocket of blue exposed ice, and I'd never seen anything like that before. It was like a big shard of a diamond. And because of the severity of the location, it's there's a population of polar bears that are native, so whenever you would leave town, you would have to carry deterrents or a firearm or a means of self-defense in regards to wavering off a polar bear. So I had a rifle and a hunting knife, and there was this intuitive drive to press the tip of the knife up against the ice and to very gently draw a mark. And that kind of instigated wanting to find a bigger amphitheater in which to perform this action in, because it felt pressing insofar as I knew that there was other glacial sites in Svalbard where you could reach the terminal endpoint where it's carving into the sea. And there was ephemeral poeticness to wanting to carve and draw a singular line at that terminal endpoint that would melt in a matter of minutes or days, and that trace would be left. And at the same time, I really liked the vulnerability of being in front of this gigantic face and the volatile nature of that, and the juxtaposition of being this human figure that's dwarfed by the landscape, but you're the biggest threat to that landscape.
I think really specifically for that site and for those that aren't aware, the Global Seed Bank is in Svalbard, and that's a it's incredibly important place that holds over 10,000 gene species of plants from across the world. And I suppose that site was built there because there's a permafrost there, that if there is a nuclear or some sort of social fallout, that site will be preserved at negative 18. So this idea that this place has that narrative already, and something that Jacobus talks about is also eco-grief. So when we're, I suppose, thinking about this space, there's other narratives around demilitarisation, but also like what it means to continue as a society. Or not, I suppose, in that place. So can you maybe talk a little bit about eco-grief, just in terms of that language that you've used?
Yeah, definitely. That kind of came to the foreground, not particularly in regards to Svalbard, but upon a trip to Greenland and travelling to the Sumek Glacier, which is one of the largest in the Northern Hemisphere. And that's when I could really grasp the concept of ecological grief that I'd read quite a bit about, just in terms of immense scale. It was something that was incomprehensible. You couldn't fathom it. And the sounds that were emanating from this whole body of, yeah, it was like a tens of cities all together that was just crumbling to pieces. And you just couldn't get a sense of the scale. And it's very difficult to describe witnessing and experiencing that. And the closest I can come to it was like it flicked a switch that was like, I liken it to beginning again. It's like traveling back from that. Just, yeah, it changed everything. Mm-hmm. And that was the entry point to really grasping the idea of ecological grief very bodily and deep down, and then bringing that knowledge to the project and being vulnerable and in more close proximity to the dangers, kind of wanting to surrender yourself to the situation.
I think too, when we speak about climate and what I suppose what we're facing, it's often spoke about in terms that are potentially invisible or private or somehow not imaged. And I think the fact that you're in these places showing us these spaces that are otherwise inaccessible is also, a huge part of your work. Thank you for talking through that. Mm. I wonder, I suppose I wanted to shift to talking to Paul, specifically about your work, Naked Souls. Mm-hmm. There's an element in the work that has a sci-fi element, and I suppose I wanted to jump there from Jacobus because this novel that Paul refers to in his work is by Kim Stanley Robinson, who's a pretty famous sci-fi author who wrote a novel called Aurora. And part of that novel is about leaving the planet because of ecological disaster and what it means to intergenerationally continue. And I wonder whether you can take that but pivot from there into into Naked Souls.
Yeah. Yeah, so this, the poetic arc of the book Aurora, Kim Stanley Robinson's known as hard sci-fi, so all the science is completely plausible. And myself personally, I probably read more biology and geology and science, natural sciences books than I probably do art myself. So my attraction to him is also in a kind of creative response that he achieves these quite poetic turn points in his books that have this, especially in Aurora, like the turning point at the end is so beautifully poetic and intimate engagement with the planet and a specific aspect of planet and how we are on the planet. And I think, as a side note, it's from reading Kim Stanley Robinson and some of these other things, but the shift from Kim Stanley Robinson is, say, this large picture where that that way of seeing yourself actually sitting on a planet, like the feeling of, you know, we're actually on a planet is like this quite profound thing, perhaps, for me anyway. But so in The Naked Souls, kind of riffing off that intimacy, you know, at different levels in the work, I guess also with the sound, with the breathing. The work has a kind of a hardness and, you know, there's a rappel aspect to it, and it also, you know, it demands a lot from an audience. So in another way, I also wanted to create this quite, you know, totally reduced proximity to kind of what life is, I suppose. And I guess for me, you know, the best thing of, the most important or valuable thing of life would be love. And then this idea that I would say that love is the most highly developed aspect of what consciousness is, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't say that it's an exclusive human thing. You know, other species have notions of love. You know, Vali Myers tells a beautiful story about one of her donkeys committing suicide after its partner donkey dies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's all these other examples of love manifest mm-hmm. in biology. And I guess... Yeah, I'm very fascinated in the way, you know, this kind of, out of this biological kind of evolution, this development of intimacy and care has come through a kind of pragmatic line for species to survive, and then as it becomes more highly and highly developed, it becomes this just totally eloquent, confusing driving factor that kind of binds, you know, it's so connective. So I guess in that, the most precious moment I have with my partner is when we're asleep. Mm. And it's when you're asleep and in the middle of the night, and it's that presence of the body that you respond to so deeply, and the body's kind of this gateway to the intellect that you love. And so it's that kind of prescient moment of that, you know, just the simplicity of the breath, you know, those two breaths being together. So I guess in the kind of hardness of naked souls, it's a kind of tricky work to unpack sometimes, but in the kind of the hardness of that and its ability to repel people, you know, I wanted to also bring in this kind of physical architecture through proximity to bodies, and also to nature, and also to nod to the situation that biology only exists because of water. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, our whole lives are kind of tied in their ability to survive is through water. And I guess for AI, if this consciousness thing can take place in a machine intelligence, it has a long way to go. But the big challenge it has also is to understand how will it kind of understand itself in relation to the body it has. Mm. And the way it will understand that, once it reaches this moment, is probably the moment where we get cut out. Because this, you know, in the same way that we can't have an integral understanding of the experience of an octopus, once the AI reaches this point, we also get cut out. So I guess, you know... And in a way, this sort of notion of water, unless electronic systems are developed in water in a way that's functional. Mm. But, you know, there's a really distinct block there that we're already... Our bodies are already locked out of each other. Mm. So I suppose somehow I wanted to bring a proximity of these impossible bodies into this space of this work.
Yeah, how do we make love to AI? I think that's the...
I mean, people
or do
trying,
we want to?
We're
trying.
Yeah. I think some things that you said really lead into Tina's work specifically about how we commune interspecies and also intergenerationally. So I wonder, can you have a little... can you lead us in that way to your work, which is downstairs?
Well, speaking of technologies and bodies, I suppose the interspecies part of my work really lies in the strength of the voice as a tool and as a medium to cross those thresholds, those species thresholds. So working with a pony club, who aren't the four horsemen of the apocalypse, but are all the six horse women to come, and they really, it's just so embedded that the voice and the breath are part of the riding practice in order for the horse to know where it stands with the human and vice versa. So I spent 4 years doing workshops with these young females, and really by increasing their capacity to project, really pragmatic stuff like to connect with their breath, to be able to move past self-consciousness, because let's face it, when it comes to singing, most of us are pretty self-conscious. So helping these young women go beyond that and to go beyond singing and voice as a fame thing or as an exceptional thing or as an elite thing, and that actually it's just a part of being and a interplanetary force. And so my role was simply to be a facilitator of that, and it wasn't till much later that it became clear that this could be an art work. And so that interspeciesness already exists within the voice. The more than human already exists in our voices. And so building that capacity to commune with one's voice beyond those kind of elitisms really produced a beautiful interspecies moment where the horses were safer for it, and so were the riders.
Can you talk a little bit about the very unlikely but shockingly similar connection between teenage girls and these aging horses?
Well, I suppose the similarity is the motion. They become one creature when they ride. So regardless of their age, their gender, their species, in that moment they actually take on a different form. Beyond the cliche of the pony club, which is very attached to young girls and horses and equine. And also there are biological similarities, and the work itself has a title that seems provocative by putting a little E in there, a little creaturely language thing, hymenals being the combination of the hymen and hymenals, which is sacred song. So by combining those linguistic worlds, you come into the teenage nervous system. And it's funny because there are all these kind of sex mythologies around teenage bodies riding horses in the hymen, and I found that really rich and interesting to kind of air. It's like this secret world that gets joked about. So what was the question there? Like they're kind of the teenage body and the old body.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose the teenage body, if they're lucky, will become an old body. And the old body was once a young body. And in that moment, they become intergenerational.
Yeah. I think as well, just thinking about, I suppose, what it means to commune both intergenerationally and also interspecies. I suppose that happened yesterday in Lawrence's performance, which was at 5 p.m. yesterday. It's also happening this afternoon, which you mentioned. I'm wondering, can you lead us into proximities? But through the history of the bell and your research around how you got to this specific object...
Yeah, I mean...
An instrument, sorry.
Yeah. We had an interesting discussion actually just while we were sitting down before about altar boys and bells, which I had not made a connection to, but I was in fact a bell ringer as an altar boy, which I've just recalled now. It's deeply trapped in there.
I
am fascinated by the bell for a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, in a purely physical way, for one, but... What was interesting about this invitation to make this project was actually spending some time really considering the kind of historical ramifications of the bell and thinking about what the bell means going forward, because I think the roles that bells have played around the world have really shifted in the last, certainly in the last sort of 50 years. Historically, when we look at the bell, the histories are around time, around worship, around labour, around taxation. There's an interesting side point, I've mentioned this to a few people, is that in a lot of European villages, the kind of distance the bell could carry was the distance that taxation could take place. So you had these villages trying to found the largest bell possible to kind of collect as much as they could. even in very recent history in the 20th century, the kind of agrarian history in Europe was radically changed through the kind of taking away of bells. So a lot of herds of goats, sheep, cattle used bells. The shepherds would use bells that had a certain tonality that would mean that was their flock. And during the Second World War, as the war wore on, the Nazis basically acquired a large percentage of those bells for munitions. Also, like a lot of the kind of old bells of Europe. And there are these incredibly powerful photos of what were called bell graveyards, where they were just sitting there waiting to be turned into bullets and whatever else. And, I mean, interestingly, the bell... So I just want to acknowledge that Anton Hassel is here, who is Australia's master bell maker and my collaborator in this project. You should all give him a round of applause.
Where
He's an amazing human. The proximity bell uses a kind of silica bronze. Anton can speak to this much more fluently than me, but which is a kind of byproduct of the Second World War as well. So there's a kind of interesting history there. But the thing for me that really interests me about this question of the bell now is, like, what is it going forward? You know, the role of the bell, the historical role of the bell has changed. And what is very special about this bell and represents sort of 50 years of Anton's life in a way is, even though it has the profile of what you would look at and think is a kind of European, a traditional European church bell, the interior profile means that the kind of fundament, the note for this one, it's a low B flat, is prominent. And usually in old world bells, there's always a minor third, a kind of dissonant tone. And this is reducing as much of that dissonant tone as it can, trying to make it more of a singular experience. And if you stand with the bell, perhaps some of you have already had a chance to ring it, when you ring it, you get this very material sensation in the body. And that's the whole point of this project, is usually we look at a bell, we think about it's a distant object. It's trapped in a belfry or somewhere that's intangible, unable to be kind of accessed by us. And this is a chance to come to an object that is usually hidden, and have a very intimate relationship with it. It's this opportunity to feel not just the kind of like the interior psychological connection to a sound, but also the kind of material, physical, bodily. That idea of the body as an ear, which is something I'm very interested in, is kind of paramount in the way that you can kind of engage with the object.
I think too there's something universal about the bell that's I suppose arisen independently all around the world as I suppose a mechanism of sound to mark time, as you've mentioned. But there was something really beautiful that happened yesterday, the minute the first moment where the bell was tolled.
I think the ding. Yeah,
the ding, there we go. Thank you. I was looking for the word. Everyone stopped and turned, and those that did know that the performance was on and those that were just walking past, everyone had that moment of whether that's somehow biological or... But there was this moment of witness, I suppose. And I wonder whether you can talk a little bit about how you... I suppose the politics of the community of listening in your work proximities.
Yeah, I think that the thing that fascinates me about what a bell does, and in fact what a lot of sound does, there's this idea called the horizon of audition. So, you know, I would argue that we are driven by our eyes. You know, we're very oculocentric kind of inhabitants of this world. Like, we look at television, we read books, but the kind of line of sight is a very linear thing for the most part. Obviously, light does bend, and we can get into quantums later. But like, when we think about light, it's a kind of there's a sort of terminus to where we can see. So for now, I can look out and I can see that painted wall over there, I can look up and I can see the sky and I can look away from that and return to it and it's still there, but there's a kind of fixed point. But if we all actually, you should all close your eyes just for 1 second, and if we just listen, suddenly all of that information that exists behind you, in fact, if you keep your eyes closed now and if you listen to my voice, you'll hear the architecture of the space that you probably have paid no attention to until this point. The way that my voice bounces off certain surfaces and the way that you can hear certain frequencies more prevalent in certain spaces. Each of you are having a completely subjective experience of my voice right now, augmented by the PA. And all of that information, those people sitting having coffee on behind you, is suddenly made available. So the horizon of audition reveals something else to us about the place that we're in. And it's also unlike the horizon of vision, it's completely transient. And unless you're paying attention to it, unless you're listening to those coffee cups and that conversation going on over there, the moment that that conversation passes, we can't return to it. It's gone forever. And that's, I think, for me, one of the great draws of working with sound is it's completely... it's in a process of constant extinction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all we do is we kind of revive it from the shallow grave of memory. That's how we kind of encounter sound a lot of the time. So I think there's a real poetics in that, and a kind of drive towards being present and attentive to what's around you. And for me, what's been such a pleasure with this bell is that it highlights that temporality and that invitation to kind of lean in, and particularly in this case, because you can lean in without being deafened by the bell, and have a very one-to-one experience with it that is exceptional. I think it's an exceptional circumstance and something that, I mean, I hope you all are able to encounter over the coming months.
Thank you, Lawrence. Just picking up on what you're saying about horizons, but also I'm wondering whether we can speak a little bit about silence as well, specifically in your work, Jacobus. For those that haven't spent much time in negative 40 weather, there's something that is incredibly deafeningly cacophonously silent about that kind of cold. And, you know, you said that sound isn't as... it's not as central, but I think if you could maybe talk about that, but also this idea of this event horizon, you specifically draw a line across a glacier, and I mean thinking about kind of that as a marker line for some sort of core sample, some sort of history that we might encounter at one point. Can you tell us about, I suppose, that and maybe this experience of silence and what it means to be alone out there?
Yeah, I think the entry point to sound in such an environment, I think of it specifically in regards to physical activity in terms of movement and the body heating up, and then all of a sudden being still when there's a break in the weather and it's still around you. And I think that's why I introduced the sound of my own heartbeat into the work to begin with, because that was primarily the entry point for every outdoor excursion that I've been on, is that putting everything down that I've been carrying and taking a moment of stillness, and that heart, your own heartbeat being amplified in your ears, because a lot of the activity would be ascending or going for hours on end, and kind of hearing your own heartbeat in conjunction with the environment you're in and having it lowered, and then that being the means to then engage with what you came there to. With a particular location here as well, there was active rockfall. It was like a gigantic auditorium with the glacier coming down between cliffs and mountains. So there was constant rockfall and constant guttural kind of grinding and aching from the glacier itself. And so there's this immediate sense of empathy you get with the particular glacial sound of itself just kind of moving. And that actually led to wanting to have my ear pressed up against the terminal face of it and to just spend a moment there before attempting to draw a line across it. But another really nice nuance of the location was standing on sea ice and taking a hydrophone to get a sample of the sound underneath it. And although it was dead quiet above, because of the tidal range, there was slight grinding between the ice sheets. And so the recording was very guttural. Mm. Yeah, it was amazing. It was incredibly violent to listen to, but yet you were standing on top and you couldn't hear a single thing. And I think that's something I wanted to carry through with the actual recording of the knife drawing a line, was to try to access something just as guttural, to translate that feeling that I got bodily from listening to the hydrophone recording. And it was difficult to balance something like that through using contact mics on the knife. The sound quality was very abstract and you couldn't really decipher what it was. And then the sound of the action itself would echo throughout the whole environment, the amphitheatre that we were based. And that's something I kind of felt I wanted to bring back to if the work was ever to be exhibited, was to have this sensation of being surrounded by this sound that's kind of encircling you and surrounding you.
Yeah, I think maybe to say, you know, when we think about the so-called Anthropocene or the capitalocene, it's but a mere slice in time. And this gesture of making a sound in this space that might not exist really does talk to your practice in the sense that you always make and often make durational performance. So can you talk about what it means to bear witness but a mere slice in time in this site as well?
I mean, it's incredibly loaded in terms of travelling there to begin with, to make such a small mark, to make a work. And there's an inherent sense of guilt attached to that that I try to balance with my actions in everyday life to make up for the mark, the unseen mark I've made on the landscape in terms of getting there to make the body of work. It just being this brief but loaded action, I think, carries a lot more gravity than other ephemeral things that I've undertaken that have been durational. When those other activities have been surrendering the body to time and to the experience that would unfold within that body of time, whereas this was a lot more specific and localized, and the whole, it generated a whole new project that's ongoing and that's very intuitive based in terms of responding to certain environments. So it's been a big turning point practice-wise, turning away from the longer durational works that I've done previously to a lot more focused interactions, gestural.
Thank you. I suppose your comment just about how you were recording underneath the ice and that kind of guttural sound, I wonder, Tina, whether you can talk a little bit about the hum and what the hum is, and also how it might calm our nervous systems.
Well, maybe we should just hum, and maybe that will just say it all, hey? So, but hum with your eyes open. This is an anti-transcendental hum, a non-well-being hum in the cliché terms. So humming is about being imminently present and responsible to our bodies and to everyone. So let's just hum with our eyes open. Are you ready? All right, breathing in. There you go. That's the hum. We don't always have to make it wordy, do we? It can also just be this. It's pre-linguistic, post-linguistic, interplanetary. It's across machines, animals. It's in between conversations. It's unintelligible. And I think there's something of great potential in that that can trouble some of the structures that we've normalised.
I wonder, the title of one of your works in the exhibition is called Chamber Music. Mm. Can you lead us into that ongoing series?
Yeah, so it started the first day I met my partner, Peter. It started that very first day. I had cameras with me. I met him. We started photographing each other. He was 100% open to me and this kind of engagement and process, and I did, you know, the same with him. And I suppose out of that response to each other and that total honest sort of offering of each other to each other, and this work became, you know, and it but very quickly within the work, I realised as the maker that it was very important for me to be as vulnerable in that position as he was allowing himself to be, and I also wanted, so I wanted us both to kind of exist in this equivalence, And then it became important. I mean, from day one, the camera moved between us fluidly. So it's almost weird sometimes that only my name is on it, perhaps. And that's only because he won't have his name on it. Mm-hmm. It's been a discussion, but he doesn't want that. But so in that spirit, you know, the camera moves between us fluidly. It gets placed on furniture without ever looking through it. It just gets pointed at us. And I guess I wanted the camera to have this equivalent agency to each of us, all of us be vulnerable together in this space. I guess, in a way, photographs are very often used to annotate difference. And I suppose in this project, it's so important for me that, you know, even though I may be capturing something that appears different, the importance is that it has this, like Lawrence was talking about, this universality. The actual, the kind of subtext of the images is the universal. And I would assume that in all of those pictures, everybody should have an equivalent memory somehow that connects to those types of images. And I suppose, I guess in a way, the ask of the artwork is to find that equivalence, to find that universality when you're looking at the work. The chamber music thing comes from my personal love of chamber music, and maybe specifically from Schubert's works of pianos for four hands. Mm-hmm. And it's the intensity of this music, actioned between, you know, two people for display in domestic settings as kind of entertainment, but also factored in context to a device or a machine, and then the kind of the emotion or narrative or, you know, the human experience that can come out of that negotiation of those three objects kind of in that space.
I think too, you said something before and also yesterday that we've all, what is universal is that we have all loved and lost. And I think the fact that your work is in the historical galleries, there's a conversation there. Can you talk to that placement and why?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, even though I suppose visually, there's a lot of visual similarities between the bodies in my photographs and, you know, the rendering of the bodies in these older paintings, like the, you know, formalities of chiaroscuro and other kind of formalities. Maybe a overt difference is the male body fell out of fashion, you know, a long time ago, and then the female body became a prominent sort of figure. But the universality of the experiences of, you know, kind of this anguish or the sheer expression of love and need and community with other people and sexuality, all of that has existed for all time anyway. Mm. And in a biological way, the human mind evolves so incredibly slower than what culture and society does. So the brain we have today is actually the brain that people had 2,000 years ago. It's just that the situation that brain exists is different. So the flex is sort of different in a way. Mm. But the core intuitive actions, responses, needs, desires are the same. They're sort of the same.
What's interesting is that the book that you've referenced also speaks to de-evolution, but I think that's another, a whole other conversation. Yeah, totally. I think we'll go to you because you woohooed just then. But also you have a performance and you're going to be here for the next month. Can you tell everyone a little bit about that?
Yes. So I'll be here in Adelaide, till the end of March and then sometime in April, and I'll be working with an ensemble of teenagers, and we'll be constructing a work together which is like a self-organizing nervous system, a teenage nervous system, maybe a very nervous system, that will be basically moving through different sites in Adelaide, different sites of exhibition, whether it be the gallery space or the zoo or the gardens or Mount Lofty. So we'll be moving through those sites, making lots of different sounds, using pop cultural references. There'll be speeches, there'll be duets, solos, and then collective moments. So, and also there'll be lots of people at these sites already, so the zoo is already a stage. And it'll be really interesting to interface with those problematics.
Thank you, Tina. Before I ask the last question to Lawrence, everyone can start thinking about their questions from the audience. Just putting that out there, because we'll open up for a couple before we close. But I wanted to ask Lawrence specifically about something actually that was in Jose's text, which is the phrasing a unifying agent. And I think there's hope embedded in that, specifically around this idea of the what you've spoken about, the politics of sound, but this idea that sound might have some sort of hopeful futurity to it, in this idea of coming together in the civic, in the city, in the architecture, and so on and so forth.
I mean, sometimes I talk about this idea of solidarity of sound, and I think it's in two parts. One is that each of us is having an independent age. I mean, hopefully you're all focused on my dulcet tones rather than the ambience around you. But like you're kind of making a choice to focus your listening. You know, there's a kind of agency there that's independent, and there's a physiological implication in that, in terms of how our bodies can listen, and a psychological one, just like how our minds allow us to process that material, and all of those understandings that we carry with us in the world that help us make our own way. So there's a kind of subjective independence that happens, but at the same time as that, we're collectively sharing this thing, and sound is this kind of like connective tissue, if you like, that travels through all of us in this moment. So we can all sit here individually, but each one of us is having a collective understanding. There's a collective understanding that can be extracted from these words, from the sounds around us, and that's always dynamic. And that dynamism asks us to lean in to that experience, I think, sometimes. And for me, that's inherently hopeful, that we're always kind of leaning in together. There's a sense of the communal, even when we are having a kind of individuated subjective experience. And something like a concert, I think, is really a great example of that, in that everyone is going to encounter that work differently and draw different meaning from it. I've played concerts where I might use a field recording, and I might know the field recording is of a windstorm in Antarctica, but people come up afterwards and say, like, I was on a boat, or I was at my beach house when I was a kid, and they have this very direct kind of memory-laden experience with it. And every person has an experience there, and it's kind of shared, and it opens these potential dialogues where people discourse with each other after the show and kind of reveal the thing that the place that they went. So I think that kind of interplay between, you know, the personal and the collective is really facilitated so well by sound and by the kind of collective promise of listening and that idea of leaning in.
On that note, on hope, does anyone have any questions at all? There's a question over here. Yeah.
This is a question for Jacobus. Anybody who's been to Svalbard or the Arctic knows it's a very fragile environment and is encouraged to respect that environment, including how you walk around and what you do, what you don't pick up. How does he justify damaging the ice in the way he has for the video upstairs? Bear in mind that that ice will be marked like that for potentially centuries, assuming the glacier or whatever it is doesn't melt.
I think maybe I'll just start with that one, if you don't mind, just quickly. I think maybe to say Svalbard's also the most rapidly warming place in the world. That's what I suppose that's what scientists are projecting. So this, but maybe you're a scientist, I'm getting that vibe. So the fact that actually it's a mark there forever, I don't actually know whether that's entirely... So do you want to speak to that?
It's not to the point whether it's there forever or not. It will be there for a period of time. Wouldn't have been there but for the desecration. And it will be a mark that I wouldn't be allowed to make without being highly criticised.
Okay.
Do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, for sure. Just to clarify, it was done at the terminal end of the glacier, so it would have melted within 5 minutes of having started and drawn it. And I got on board Polarex, which was a specific guiding company that deals with logistics in the Arctic and the Antarctic. And so they're in collaboration with the local governor of Svalbard in terms of like permitting travel through sanctioned areas that are okay to travel on and not to damage the environment.
Thank you. Other questions? There's one at the back.
I'm kind of riffing a bit off of that question, but more generally, there was a conversation about the non-humans' presence in your works, and I just wanted to ask, how do we as artists kind of navigate that kind of human mastery of the non-human?
Do you want to answer that one?
Yeah, sure, I'd love to. Well, for me personally, it's contextual, so it's not about generalising the more than human experience as it is about not generalising the human experience either. So in that sense, I'll probably trouble some of the ideas of universalisation. It's contextual and it's time-based, and the artist has to be implicated in the care that's needed around those bodies. And for me, with the horses, that's a 10-year engagement with the same horses and rocking up every weekend, cleaning their shit, cleaning their hooves, understanding what they need for parasitical stuff. And the same thing with the girls, like having those weekends of conversation that goes way beyond the aesthetic outcomes that the art exceptionalist world demands. So, yeah, that's my ethic, and I have that across multiple bodies and sites where that happens.
Does anyone else want to speak to that?
I don't know. I didn't understand.
Are there any other questions from the crowd? I think maybe I'll just ask the artist, is there anything else that you'd like to add before we wrap up? What would you like to leave us with this morning?
I suppose we could also ask each other, like, be more in conversation. It's funny, this is very frontal, and there's a stage and a platform, and you guys are over there. So that in itself is kind of weird, I think. So maybe it's maybe more here. I don't know.
Do you have any questions for one another?
Oh, I was going to suggest a communal hum just to wrap it up.
Oh, yeah. To do another one.
Yeah, but with the microphones.
And actually, can I ask that we kind of trouble the hum just a little bit, because the hum is a closed mouth thing, which was great for COVID, by the way. But maybe let's open the mouth and make it more a hum to an ah. Let's get some more exhale, more like breathing, blood flow happening.
I feel if you're going to ask that, you may need to conduct that gesture.
Oh,
I'm just going to say that.
Absolutely. So, yeah. I'd love to. Okay. So everyone, let's breathe in. And then ah.
Please join me in thanking Lawrence, Paul, Jacobus, and Tina.
Yay. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, AGSA. Thank you.